This is an oral history of lawyer Brooke Oliver for the Mission Murals Project. I'm Camilo Garzón. It was recorded on July 20th, 2021, inside of a conference room at 50 Balmy Law, which is at the heart of Balmy Alley. The voices you'll hear will be those of Brooke and my own. As soon as I met Brooke, she gave me her business card. This oral history delves into the facets of Brooke's early life, her upbringing, meeting her wife Elba Rivera, alongside Susan Cervantes, Irene Perez, Esther Hernandez, and others the same night, and how her law career placed her at the forefront of visual arts legislation in the United States. We talk about the cases she has defended in front of the Supreme Court, her law practice, about social justice issues related to race, sexual orientation, gender expression, among others, her work as a self-described cultural justice warrior, and her role in helping preserve and amplify Chicanx and Latinx heritage in San Francisco's Mission District and beyond. Here is the oral history. All right, so I'm here with Brooke Oliver, and we are inside of 50th Balmy, which to me is very surprising because I've been around here passing Balmy Alley a lot, many times doing this project. And Brooke has been part of this whole Mission Murals since the 70s and 80s. These have been very important pieces of work. And you've done something very specific in terms of how to understand visual arts under the law. And those repercussions are not only local and state, they are also global, because it is San Francisco that really made sure that we respect murals as an art form across the world. Before we get into all of that, I would love to hear you say your name, full name, and your upbringing. Where were you born?
Hi, my name is Brooke Oliver. I was born in Denver, Colorado, and I was raised in Tucson, Arizona, right on the border.
Those two things. What of your upbringing do you remember most in both having the Colorado, the high altitudes, but at the same time then going to the desert and having these kinds of very interesting, in many senses contradictory, microclimates?
Oh, I don't remember anything about Denver. My family left when I was 6 months old. So I lived in Tucson for most of my youth. Lived in San Diego for a little bit of time when I was young in elementary school, but primarily grew up in Tucson, Arizona. And, you know, the desert was always a really huge part of me and my reality, as was Latin culture, because the language, the place, everything, it's really Mexico. It's not really the United States. And so I learned Spanish at a very early age because I was nosy and wanted to know what people were talking about. And then when I learned Spanish from people and I started taking classes as a kid, I started getting introduced to Latino culture in Tucson at a time when it was an extremely racist place. It still is, but then it was extremely racist. And so that kind of always offended me. My parents, my grandmother were Southern, and you know, I was told I couldn't go swimming in the public pools, and that didn't make any sense to me at all. It was 110 degrees. That was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard. So it just kind of on an intimate level of, you know, just, why can't I go swimming? That's stupid, you know? When I was a kid, these things kind of made an impression on me. And then I left Tucson when I was 17 and went to school at UC Davis and got really involved in organizing for the United Farm Workers boycott of grapes and lettuce when I was in school there. And then I was a translator at DQ University.
All of these things that you've been telling me, I think still to this day reflect your interests, but more than anything, your curiosity. And that kind of curiosity and like
in a sense, you just don't eat things as they give them to you. If you are told something, you always were very skeptical about the specificities of why is it that this thing that they're telling me is normal when it's not. And you took that not only into your schooling and after UC Davis, which you graduated from the highest honors in your Bachelor of Science, you then went into law. When you were organizing for Lechugueros, which is such an important and essential aspect of a lot of the artists that then you ended up meeting later on and even during those times, what are some of the things that really motivated you to organize, but also to try to understand how can I help them? What was like the impetus for those things?
Well, I dropped out of college and I was a full-time organizer, a labor organizer for about 10 years, organizing attendant care workers and domestic workers, trying to get better wages, better working conditions. I helped get AFSCME involved at UC Davis. I was the coordinator of the Tom Hayden's campaign. I've just always felt like creating social change was an important responsibility of any of us who are living and breathing, and you know, the air on the planet, and gratitude for the things that, you know, working people create and make and bring to our tables. So, I guess I've always, yes, curious, yes, not accepting authority or the usual story about the usual suspects, but also just feeling part of society and part of the planet and having a responsibility to be engaged.
I think that the contexts that you have been in, living in, or even that you decided to partake in, have informed your decisions throughout your life, as you have just noted. One of the interesting things that I've seen is when you graduated from your law school, you did start being recognized as a person to go to for these kinds of things that other people wouldn't go to. What am I talking about? If I am a muralist, if I am a visual artist, and I have zero people in my life that know about intellectual property, copyright law, anything that deals with what it is that I need to know about my own work being respected, valued, and also not vandalized or copied, or you would be the person to go to. And you're very well known to this day as one of the people to go to. What is it that makes you the person that these people go to? What is it from you that is, other than your credentials, but you as a person, what are the things that you say, these of myself, I think this is why people like Susan Cervantes, Esther Hernandez, all of these people have talked to you. What are the characteristics?
I think it's because I'm committed to art as a medium of social change, and I get it as being part of a movement. So my great-grandmother was a professional artist. I've always loved art, and I'd always, you know, going past the freeways, going through the San Francisco, I'd always seen these murals, and I thought they were being done by magical people who would go out and not commodify their artwork, but would do these massive paintings on the walls that share this history and stories of organizing and social change with everybody. So it really interested me, and I started going out and, you know, going to Mission Cultural Center, where I met my wife. I started, you know, one of my downstairs neighbors was a muralist, and she said, people keep stealing this stuff. Is there anything I can do about it? And I said, yeah, there is. And that was when I was in law school, and I got a bunch of law students together to register the copyrights and murals, and got a law firm to donate the money to pay for the registration fees for it. And we just went out and for free started doing this work to get the copyrights and the murals registered. And, you know, so I guess I showed up and I was interested. And when people would ask me to help, I give plain English, straightforward, clear legal advice. And when I take on a case, I usually win it. I've taken risks to win cases. The first federal visual artist rights case that really was a big victory was my case, and it was about the Lily Ann mural here in the Mission. So, you know, it's an unusual niche, and I do it very well, and I'm respectful, and I learn from the people that I'm working with. I don't just try to apply, you know, one set of, you know, here's the law, this is what you have to do, you know, da da da. I'm not pompous.
No, I think if anything, the word respect and understanding the dignity of these artists as people really comes to mind with you and your work, because you just referred to one of the biggest cases of your career, which really set up a precedent legally and the jurisdiction of the understanding that a lot of the murals that exist in San Francisco are just right outside these doors.
That's right. You know, here in San Francisco, in a small geographical area, the murals are highly visible.
Right.
So there's lots of murals and they're highly visible because they're all right here. Yeah, the density.
It's the density. It is really fascinating that you talk about your practice as very like straightforward, and you're just gonna give them the answers in English. And I feel like that's an important element of some of the clients that you've taken, including Acción Latina, as I was just mentioning, Esther Hernandez, but also the Dolores Huerta Foundation. These are all people that have been very important, not only in terms of just social and just, you know, like civic rights, like just like the actual dignity and humanity of these people under the law in the United States. They've also been people associated with these arts movements. They were not separate, they were actually very interrelated. And I think you've understood that as you were highlighting. When you think of some of these artists, especially the ones that really taught future generations how to make this art and how to understand it, what are some of the first memories of working with some of these muralists, maybe especially in the Mission?
Just to add to some of the lists that you'd mentioned, I'm also the United Farm Workers Union intellectual property lawyer, so I protect Si Se Puede and the Black Eagle from being stolen. So, you know what? So I don't know. You know, I think that, you know, I started going to events in the Mission. I started meeting people. People started calling me. And then because the graphics of the work are dramatic, I started getting a lot of press coverage too. So California Lawyer magazine did a cover story on the work I was doing early on in my career. I went back to law school when I was 36. I graduated when I was 39. And then I started my law practice straight out of law school. I didn't go to work for a big firm. So I had an opportunity to work with people in creative ways that I might not have had in big law. Now I've made a career and I'm famous enough that big law wants me. And so I'm now associated with Procopio, which is a really fine law firm with lots of resources that they're making available to all my clients too. So So I don't, you know, I don't know. I think that there's this overall sense of the Chicano movement in the United States, and Muralismo is very directly connected to that movement for civil rights and social justice, labor rights. The union was always, had lots of artists that were working with it. The UFW had lots of artists that were working with it. The Royal Chicano Air Force, an iconic mural arts or organization of muralists out of Sacramento, did all kinds of organizing with the UFW. I was in school at UC Davis right during those times, and you know, it became part of my life. You know, the art and the history of the Chicano movement are completely integrated, and it resonated with me as a kid from Tucson. I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
Maybe no, you are, and the interesting part of it is one thing that I have noticed with all of these conversations I've been having is either you all are very modest about what you did, or the answers are just limited to the understanding that some others like us have of what you did. I think that you're very modest about the significant steps you did, and you did answer the question. What is it of all of these different projects or different clients that you've had, right, that you remember the most in terms of the most important legal battles or distinctions? Because a lot of these terms came to be thanks to a lot of your work too, or a lot of the actual jurisprudence of understanding the legalese behind what is a mural, what isn't, and what is protected by the law. A lot of your work is behind the scenes letting them have the possibility of continuing to express something that has these kind of social significance. What are some of those terms or some of these things that you yourself and other associates of yours helped coin or helped really contribute to really solidifying a definition or making sure that there's a protection under the law? What are some of those things?
Well, we were among the first to even register the copyrights in murals and to be able to define whether a mural had been published for legal purposes or was unpublished, which allowed for the registration and protection of a lot of muralist rights under the law, because you can't, you know, people, you get the copyrights whether or not you register them, but you can't file a lawsuit, you can't exercise those rights. So we created the groundwork for the registration of murals as unpublished works, giving the artists substantially more protection and legal rights than they had otherwise. I also am the foremost practitioner of the Federal Visual Artists Rights Act and the California Art Preservation Act, and I've written about it and spoken about it and litigated it. And you know, we made a real change in how real estate developers and property owners deal with murals that are painted on their walls, so that because we litigated and won several of those cases, and it was really public, people started being a lot more cautious about whether they were going to just go out and paint over a mural, because they would get sued if they did that. And then we also worked with the city of San Francisco and other cities to create language that didn't require artists to fully waive all of their Visual Artist Rights Act, because in response to some of that litigation, property owners and the city, and even now the City Art Commission, which is so wrong, actually tries to get artists to waive all their Federal Visual Artist Rights Act. So that's those rights are about the protection of the original piece of artwork, not just reproduction rights, right? The reproduction stops people from making copies and selling them. That's an important bundle of rights. It also, you know, or using it in a film or using it in a Super Bowl commercial or those kinds of things. Lots of the cases I've done, you've never heard about because we settled in confidential settlements, but it made ripples that made people recognize that murals are works of fine art and protected under federal law. And we also created a jurisprudence around the Federal Visual Arts Rights Act and the California Art Preservation Act, and when each of them is appropriate to use. In fact, we just did a case, had a really successful resolution in a case against Caltrans and LA Metro that they painted over Judy Baca's iconic Hitting the Wall mural in downtown Los Angeles. And in a very unique settlement, we were able to get a resolution where they are paying for that mural to be restored, and the layers of paint are just coming off of that beautiful woman athlete, beautiful woman runner, and she's coming out into the light of day again just ahead of the Los Angeles Olympics.
That is just so important. On Friday, I was talking to Amalia Mesa Baines and just the significance of Judy Baca for not only for, you know, art history, but also just her significance in terms of just the social contribution of her art. I'm very happy to see the real application of your litigation and also just of your clients being represented in the way you have, because I feel like a lot of the people, including myself, just as Latinos in the United States, unless you practice law, unless you have a lawyer in your family, there's not a lot of people that back in those days, especially 70s and 80s, knew about what was protected or even the distinctions of what fine art could be under the eyes of the law, could even be. And you've made it possible to be respected. You've made it possible to also just be honoring the legacies of a lot of these artists. When you think of some of the artists that either have been clients of yours, of course you cannot talk about a lot of different things, but even if it's not clients, but friends, people that you've come to know closely, what are some of these artists that have still some of the murals painted in Balmy Alley or around here, even Mini Park, that you still have fond memories of or things that you would like to remember about them and you? What are some of those stories?
Wow. Just about all of them, you know, most of the muralists have been clients and friends. Even Judy Baca in LA were really close friends, in addition to her being a client. And so I've had great times with Judy. Getting a chance to have her give me a personal tour of the Great Wall of Los Angeles, and then, you know, on the Tujunga Wash, a half-mile-long mural, and then to be with her for the first time that she went to the retrospective of her work last weekend at the Museum of Latin American Art. And they did a completely immersive experience of the Great Wall of Los Angeles. And we sat in there as the mural was, you know, the Tujunga Wash was just ripped through the desert, you know, through the land, and then became built, and then the painting of the mural, and all of the kids that worked with her, hundreds of gangbangers and kids and, you know, people who didn't have anything to rely on, and they went down into that wash and worked and worked and worked and created this magnificent piece of art. And then to see that whole thing going in motion, the sketches and then being colorized and then in motion around four walls of a major museum, when Chicana artists just have never had a retrospective like that anywhere, we were all in tears. To go from walking the actual mural with her to being present the first time she saw it displayed in that way was profoundly moving. It was really exciting. Being able to go out and with the, mural after mural, being able to go out with conservators and the muralists themselves when a mural has been painted over, and to show that that mural can be uncovered and revealed to the light of day again, even when somebody has disrespected it so much as to paint over it. Like, why would you, nobody would go into a house and paint over a painting hanging on their wall. Why would you think it's okay to do that on a giant painting that somebody spent months working on with their little paintbrushes, Susan Cervantes and Esther has taken me into her studio and showed me her prints and talked about her art process. I mean, I've had an opportunity to be right there with people while they're painting, while they're creating their work, while they're making the designs, while they're explaining how they've made changes. Irene and the women's building muralists, we started a really, they managed to create a partnership that has lasted to license and create a book and, to continue to give that mural life. And we worked out an arrangement with the women's building so that when they needed to make changes to the building, the muralists were brought back in to restore it as an integral part of remodeling a building. So to create that kind of collaboration and dance between building owners and artists that allows these works of art to live on in somewhat new forms it's been really fun. I mean, it's been great, Like, most lawyers spend their time going to bar associating meetings or hanging out with lawyers, and I was like, oh my god, I can go hang out with artists and creative people and learn about their creative process and what their work represents and how it changes. So I mean, I've had that kind of experience with almost all of the muralists. I go out to the walls and I watch when they're painting.
You have had such a first-person perspective as a lawyer, but also as a human, witnessing and being able to document memories of what these walls have meant throughout the years, decades. And when I hear your stories currently, one of the things that really is interesting and fascinating to me is a lot of the moments in which these artists feel the most, I would say, violated, because it is a violation of their own work.
Yeah.
Is when these kinds of things happen, which they happen very often. Like, I've heard it from Juan Alicia, from Susan, from most of the mujeres muralistas, of people just coming and tagging or just like ripping parts of some of these more elaborate murals. And the care and work that they need to put in to kind of restore it, and being able to restore it, as you're saying. Do you have any of the stories of something you might have witnessed, or of a story of a friend whose mural was vulnerated in this way? Is there any story that jumps to mind?
I have to be very, very careful because, pretty much most of what I do is privileged and confidential. So part of that is, a professional obligation, but part of it also is the way in which I have kept people's trust, even though I'm working with lots of people who run in the same circles and are close with one another, is that when people talk to me or show me things or do things with me, that I don't gossip about it. No chisme. So, so for example, that, you know, that settlement about hitting the wall, that's not confidential, so I can talk about that. And there's a lot going on in the press right now where you can find a lot of the images and on Facebook that is showing that work being restored. That's the reason I'm talking about that one, in addition to it being really current. Some of the ones where I've litigated, filed a lawsuit, those cases are public, but their resolutions might be private. So I think I don't want to tell tales about the people I know.
Yeah, no, I understand the fascinating part of...
I mean, I can tell you, like, my wife is a muralist. I met my wife here in Balmy Alley, you know, and then she was doing a mural on her Elba Rivera. She was doing a mural on her elementary school over at what's now Cesar Chavez School. Used to be Hawthorne when she went to elementary school there. And, you know, I met her at Mission Cultural Center, and I met Susan Cervantes that same night, and a lot of the other artists that same night. I didn't become a lawyer until 1994, so I wasn't doing it in the 70s or 80s. And this Federal Visual Arts Rights Act law wasn't passed and didn't become effective until June 1991. So, you know, there was no case law in it when I first became a lawyer. That's why I made the case law. I've been in Balmy Alley all the time, you know. I mean, she was painting a mural right across the street from the alley, Elba was, and I thought she was hot, so I was hanging out while she was painting, and I guess she returned, she felt the same way. The people that lived here wanted to sell the property, and you know, they thought it was a terrible neighborhood. The projects were down there. It was pretty crazy. And I said, well, we'll take it off your hands. Yeah, it's terrible, but okay. And so we were able to buy this property really inexpensively. And because of that, I've been able to do a lot of this work at a discounted rate, too. So, you know, I don't know. What can I tell you?
The first thing that I really appreciate from you is that we're having to navigate several different things, not only in terms of professional privilege, but also in terms of personal privilege. And those are very important things that I feel are very important to maintain. No chisme here. We're not wanting chisme. It's more... there's so many memories that rest in each one of the people, including yourself, that I'm talking to, that one of the things, for example, is just, as you just said, you just met your wife in Balmy. She was painting here. And that is fascinating. That's a beautiful story. If anything, I want to ask you about that. And after that, I would love to ask you a little bit about your specific social stance on LGBTQ plus rights, because that has been a big part of your, not only work, but in a sense, advocacy. Like, you've done a lot for yourself and others in this way too.
Yeah.
So let me start with the first one, which is the beautiful story that you more or less hinted at, which is your wife was painting a mural in Balmy Alley, and how did you two just meet and continue creating this legacy that you've also both created? How did that happen?
Well, remember I told you there was a muralist who lived downstairs from me. I was living up in Bernal Hill. Her name is Patricia Rose, and she's the docent at Procida Eyes. And so she said, is there anything we can do about this? And I said, yes. And she says, well, come to me to the Mission Cultural Center. There's an opening. I want you to meet a lot of people. So we went to this opening at Mission Cultural Center, I guess 27 years ago now, 27 years ago. And Elba Rivera, my wife, my now wife, that was when I first met her. So I met Elba and Susan Cervantes and Esther Hernandez and like a dozen other of the great muralists, Irene and Lorraine Garcia Nakala, and you know, a lot of other people right there, right then, that night. And my life changed. So that's when I started, I told Procida Eyes, it's like, I'll register the copyrights if you let me do all the licensing and infringement work for you. And she said, okay, whatever, you know? So we started doing that. So Elba and I met there, and then there was a Procida Eyes youth mural arts event in Procida Park that they hold every single year, and I was there, and I went to see what that was about, and Elba was there, and she had a little chihuahua at the time, and that little chihuahua was one of these San Francisco summer days that Mark Twain talks about being the coldest winter you ever experienced, and so that little chihuahua was just suffering. She was so cold. So I picked her up and I put her in my jacket right here, right? And the chihuahua is all happy and Elba looks at me. She got so fresh. She said, I wish I could be there. And I was like, oh, matter of fact, so do I. So then we started dating and the rest is history. We've been together for 25 years and yeah, when I was in law school, I was the editor-in-chief of the Law Review, and I wrote an article about all of the laws that protected straight people's marriages. There were 3,000 different statutes that protect straight people's marriages. And as LGBTQ and trans folks, we're not allowed to marry at that time. So I felt really strongly about LGBTQ civil rights and, you know, as well as racial justice issues. My daughter's half black and we ran into a lot of prejudice in a small town that we lived in up in the mountains of the Sierras, and you know, it was real ugly stuff. So I wanted to do racial justice and LGBTQ stuff, and then I met Elba and Patricia and all these other artists, and I was like, well, I can do art too. That's incredible, you know, because people tell you, you know, they tell people not to be artists because you can't make a living, and they tell lawyers not to do art law because you can't make a living. But you know, anything that you take a risk at, you know, there's going to be some reward for it, right? So people were willing to take a risk on me early in my legal career, partly because I was a grown-up person. You know, like I said, I was nearly 40, and I had a lot of. I'd been an organizer, I'd been in business, I had all that. I wasn't like a young lawyer who didn't even know what insurance was, right? So I could bring all that life experience and apply the law to it. So Elba was really happy to work with me. She came in and became the bookkeeper because she was really good at numbers. So it was a little bit of a mom and mom business for a long time. She retired about 4 years ago. And she's a muralist and an artist, and it became our life. And then I got real involved. I was general counsel for San Francisco Pride I'm the lawyer for the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. They sainted me. I'm Saint Brooke of the Patent Leather Legal Briefs, which is a huge honor. And, you know, I've done a lot of advocacy that I've been recognized for, kindly. And then I think probably my most famous case is the Dykes on Bikes trademark, where I went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court twice because the trademark office was rejecting that as a trademark and saying it was derogatory to lesbians. And I was like, wait, let me explain. You know, this is, we've recategorized that from an epithet to a symbol of pride as women ride down Market Street rumbling their motorcycles, you know, making the walls shake. Dykes on Bikes is a matter of pride. We've recaptured that. And they're like, no. I found this thing in a 1915 Webster's Dictionary that says it's derogatory. It's not even in print anymore. What are you talking about? Here's a 2-foot stack of evidence. And they were not persuaded. And so we had to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then we had to go back again more recently, and finally the law that allowed the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to decide for others what's derogatory and what isn't was found to be unconstitutional. So.
You have had such a storied career, not only in law, but also organizing, as you were saying, in business. One of the most important things that I think sometimes has been the case is that people separate themselves as a subject with the aspects of their lives, especially professional, that also touch upon those subjectivities, those identities. You, of all people, knew exactly what you were talking about because it affected people like you, right?
Yeah.
And queer people, just people part of this community, know what it is that they're doing to reclaim certain things. And the beauty of this example is also the fact that you're really making sure that they understand that the language and the use of these expressions has changed throughout time too.
That's
and
right.
It will continue to change throughout time too. Because it's about who uses the words and how they get used. And
that's right.
It's just a beautiful part of also what you've done throughout the legacy of a lot of these other art forms too. And a lot of your friends, too, are part of the community. People like Irene Perez. Just the fact that you all knew each other and the fact that you all also shared certain identities, I think maybe helped each other, right? Just as humans, not only in business, not only in terms of making sure that these things are protected as they should, because they are. It just feels like you all created a community of support that still to this day keeps going on strong. And one of the things that I feel seems to be or have happened is that because of gentrification, because of so many different things that have happened to San Francisco and have happened around the world too, a lot of these people do not live in the Mission anymore if they did. You're one of the few with Elba. How have you seen that change personally? And how has that affected some of your friends and yourself?
Well, yes, a lot of the artists have moved out of the city. And, you know, that started happening, you know, not just recently, but with the first tech bubble in the 90s. And so, you know, I mean, it's really affected us. But people still come back for events, right? People come back to Balmy Alley. People come back. Galleria de la Raza has been a really central gathering place in the events that it holds. You know, I've done legal work for them, for the Chicana Latina Foundation, which has been really instrumental in promoting the success of Latinas in the world. So there are, you know, there are some nonprofit organizations that really hold the fabric of the community together in their hands. With COVID, of course, that changed it even more significantly, because, you know, we couldn't see each other. You couldn't hug, you know, you don't have the, you know, you're not seeing people in three dimensions anymore. But we did learn how to stay in touch through Zoom and through other things. There have been, you know, the folks who are not really, don't love technology as an intermediary, you know, grown further apart, and that's been sad. And to be honest, Elba and I are spending a lot of our time outside the city. We had 47 acres out in the foothills of the Sierras south of Yosemite that we'd been going out to, like, just, you know, every couple of months and camping. But when COVID hit, we just moved out there. And we've been building a place. And so we're spending a lot of our time out there. Elba's lived in the mission since 1959, and she's a little bit over it. You know, it's really not the same as it was 10 years ago. You know, I mean, we had like a super strong community, and it was really working class here. And a lot of the working class people have really had trouble hanging on and have left. I mean, right here on Balmy Alley, there's a bunch of working class people that still live here, and, you know, we speak Spanish and hang out together, but we're not even spending as much time in the city. It's just hard. It's hard to be here. And, you know, when COVID hit, there's so many people who depend on me. If I'd gone down, it would have really impacted a lot of people. So I had to do everything I could to protect myself. And then, of course, the first event I go to in 18 months, I catch a cold. Mm. So annoying. But it didn't really matter, right, if we were here or if we were 4 hours away, because you couldn't see each other anyway, you know? So, but and we got, you know, we got used to getting up with a cup of coffee and going out and listening to the birds instead of listening to the drunks going by. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, you just highlighted all of the many changes that have happened, especially in the 90s, as you said, that's when you became a lawyer. That's exactly when a lot of the tech boom, the first one, the big one, happened. And the good thing, what I hear, is that while the community is no longer so concentrated in this area, the community still exists.
It just happens
to be somewhere else, or it just has different, like, nexus or different points of convergence. And one thing that I've heard from you is the essence of why nonprofits sometimes have been so important for these kinds of things. And in the interest of time, I only have two more questions. One of them is about Calle 24 and the Latino Cultural District, because I think that has been also quite the most, you know, like one of the most essential parts for what Balmy became.
Yeah.
What are your memories of that time when you helped co-found this?
You did your research, huh? So that was one of the things that a lot of the veteranos and veteranas living here decided to do to protect the neighborhood from gentrification. We saw what was happening on Valencia Street. The combination of storefronts, the evictions of longtime business owners, you know, the turning it into just like a, you know, a nightclub strip of fancy restaurants and dance clubs for the texters and techies, and then the big buses coming in, the Google and Facebook buses, these faceless white buses rolling through the neighborhood, huge, and it, you know, that they were white wasn't lost on any of us as you know, it really felt like the conquistadors coming in. I mean, it was really bad. And so David Campos and Hillary Ronan, who's the supervisor now, Eric Arguello, some other really key activists here, John Mendoza, Miguel Bustos, we started working to create legislation that would create a Latino cultural district that wouldn't just create it like Olivera Street, which is cultural tourism, but that would support, you know, stores and you know, like not just gift shops, but stores where people can get masa, where people can get the spices that go in the food that they're traditionally used to eating, and that new restaurants would have to have menu items that are affordable to families, and, you know, stopping storefronts from being combined into bigger storefronts to try to keep the businesses that serve the Latinx community, the working people in the Latinx community, in place. So that what that did, so we passed that legislation, and then we set up a nonprofit to essentially govern that, and we worked really hard to come up with bylaws that would reflect the values of, you know, of maintaining long-term residence. And so then I wrote those bylaws in consultation with people, and then those became models for the other cultural districts that have since been set up in San Francisco, of how you can structure the constitution of an organization to reflect the values and to get the leadership that's going to maintain those values. So I did that. We all worked really hard on making those a thoughtful structure in ways that would mean that, you know, new residents, gentrifiers, couldn't come in and take over the organization and just vote out indigenous leadership. So that was a big part of what we did there. It was really fun. And it's worked.
It has worked. And these are some of the ripples that we've been talking about in this conversation, that even sometimes, as you were saying, you might not be able to like disclose certain things just because that's the nature of your work. These are some of the also larger effects of what you've done with other people as well. One last question, which is just a more personal question, and you can take it as whatever you want to say. I've been asking this just because oral histories are such a beautiful vehicle to understand people and to understand their place in places, right? Like what they did, what motivated them. I could ask you, how would you like to remember the mission, or like how would you like the legacy of some of the things, like when you worked with the Cesar Chavez Foundation or other things. I could ask you about those things. I want to ask you personally, yourself. How would you like yourself and your work to be remembered?
I'd like to be remembered as a cultural justice warrior. That, you know, that I'm a fighter with integrity and values, connected to comunidad, and connected to both the LGBT community and connected to the mission community. As a really long term, that it's integrated into my life and my work, and that I'm very honored to be trusted by as many people as I am, and I endeavor to earn that trust every single day.
I think one thing that I, from this conversation, from just getting to know you before you and this conversation happened, one of the things that you mentioned today that really, really stuck with me is that you have to take a risk, and most of the time, that risk, in one way or another, will reap reward. Sometimes the reward might just be the end in itself, which might be just a human relationship that lasts for a long time. And while a lot of these people have trusted you, I think you've also trusted them.
Yes.
And you've also put yourself there, and the community is the better for it. So Brooke, just thank you so much for just having this time to just reminisce, talk about so many memories, and it's been a true honor to just be able to even pick your brain and to understand you as a person. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much. It's you know, when you're running through life doing what you do, it's you don't often have an opportunity to sit and reflect like this, and I really appreciate the chance to do so. Thank you.
Thank you.
After we finished the oral history, I was greeted by Elba Rivera, the Salvadoran-born artist who Brooke later married on a pirate ship in San Francisco. Brooke was about to enter a meeting, but before she did, she was gracious enough to show me around her office and show me some of the keepsakes, art, and photographs she has been collecting throughout her career. Here is an audio record of that tour.
What are some of the things that we have around us that you would like to tell me about?
Well, let's see. There's my sainthood from the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. I'm Saint Brooke of the patent leather legal briefs. The sisters do this really nice thing of honoring activists who've helped the queer community. And then you're always called Saint Brooke or something. It's pretty neat.
Defender of rights and keeper of the marks.
That's right. This is a picture of Esther Hernandez and Dolores Huerta at my 25th business anniversary. We had a big party and did a benefit for Emilio Huerta's campaign for Congress, or for the Board of Supervisors. This is me and Dolores at Che Guevara's family home in Havana. We went to Cuba together, and then I was asked to come consult with Che's familia. So this is his widow and their family lawyer, and you know, they were cautious about who was going to come, but I said I had to have a translator. So Dolores came as my translator, and that was an amazing thing.
Sorry, what?
Dolores came as my translator.
Are you kidding me? Dolores Huerta is your translator at Che Guevara's wife's home.
Yes.
Are you kidding?
I'm okay. Not kidding.
All right. And then...
That was pretty fun.
No, that's
right?
Incredible. Yeah. You got also some anime, and you also have these beautiful pieces of art. What are those two pieces?
Well, the anime, I'm the lawyer for the largest anime convention in North America, and their board president came in and said, "You don't have any anime art. What's wrong with you?" So I got this huge piece of anime art. I said, "All right, are we done?" But I like it because it's got a woman warrior there. She's got a big sword. She's fighting for justice in that piece. So that's all good. This one is a painting by my wife, Elba Rivera, and it's a flamenco dancer, but it's a flamenco dancer who's wearing pants. So that was remarkable, and so I have that here in my office. And then we got to go to visit a client whose studio was in Spain. Right, you know, you could see the Rock of Gibraltar from his studio. That's his work, Michael Parks. And he and his wife took us to Sevilla to see real flamenco dancers. So we have that here. And then we have, this is my great-grandmother's work. She was a professional artist in the 20s and 30s and still has work in the St. Augustine Museum of art. She founded the St. Augustine.
Florida?
Yeah.
For real. So I probably have watched. Oh,
yeah.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah.
After we finished the tour of her office, I went back to the conference room to pack up my gear and noticed the many alebrijes and art law books that she had in there. And after I finished packing up my gear, I went outside the room and heard the fountain in Elba's and Brooke's home right next to the 50 Balmy Law office before I left to venture into Balmy Alley from having talked to one of its most staunch defenders and experts. This oral history of Brooke Oliver was a collaborative effort, like murals also are. The team behind it was
Erica Gengzi,
Maisa Plunk Graham,
who served as executive producers,
Natalia De La Rosa,
who served as a production assistant. The rest of the team included
Javier Briones,
Kevin Carr,
Chad Perver,
Carrie Cordova,
Stephanie Garces,
Melissa San Miguel.
And it was produced and mixed by me, Camilo Garzón. The Mission Murals Project was organized by the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art and funded by the Institute for Museum and Library Services. Thanks for listening.